from A1 Studios in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, New York. This is the Rob Aguilar Show.
So, Doctor, you are going to help us figure out this complex thing we like to call a woman's mind.
Okay.
And a lot of the emails and questions that we get from guys, they tell us about their current status in their relationships where it turns out that the woman that they're dating has gone psycho on them.
Mm-hmm.
Temper tantrums, violence,
okay.
Things getting thrown around. And they always wonder if there was ever any signs that they could have looked for early on in the relationship that could have told them, you know what, maybe you shouldn't go too deep into a relationship with this woman because there's something psycho about her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it'll save everyone a lot of heartache.
Okay.
So from your experience, is there anything that we can look for that will help us or give us a glimpse into the future with certain women?
Yeah, well, I've dealt with a lot of clients, both male and female, who are dating or in relationships, and there are always signs. I wouldn't necessarily say psycho, but there are signs that the relationship probably won't work out. And some of those signs are people will tell you early on, like on first dates, really who they are. So you have to be open to listening, I think, to who the person is. If they're telling you that they've stalked people before, that's probably not a good sign.
No, definitely not.
Right. If they're kind of needy, probably not a good sign. One of the things I found quite a bit in terms of relationships with clients is that family of origin, history with family is really important and is really a good sign to tell you that who this person is and the relationship might not be so good. So, for example, if you're dating someone and they tell you on a first date or, you know, a couple of dates into the relationship or dating that they don't get along with their parents, that's probably a sign that you're going to have some problems in the relationship.
That is very interesting.
I can tell you, like, for example, a few clients who have talked about early on dating folks and, you know, asking questions, guys will ask questions about a woman's background, you know, how do you get along with your family? And if they tell you, I don't like my parents, I don't get along with my parents, or I haven't spoken to my parents in some time, that usually is a clue that it's not going to turn out so well. And that has to do a lot with psychological stuff and theory and a lot to do with family of origin issues. So if people are not really attached or connected to their parents, it's going to be really hard for them to be in a relationship.
That makes a lot of sense. And it's very interesting because I think our first bond as children is with our parents.
Exactly.
And I think, for example, with boys, there's always a strong bond with the mother early on.
Mm-hmm.
I see it with my child. My son is only 18 months, but he is like attached to his mom. Like his mom
mm-hmm.
is his world. And when he's feeling sick, I will come by and maybe try to pick him up and he'll be open to that.
Mm-hmm.
But then he wants mom,
yeah.
Mom. And when he's with her and he's feeling sick, then he feels better. It's really interesting, that strong bond.
Yeah.
So if someone is saying that they don't have a good relationship with their parents, then something during that bonding process, maybe as children, didn't take place or wasn't healthy. Can we assume that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's different in every case, but I think you can assume that if there was not a really good attachment when the person was young, that that's probably going to create some problems down the line. You know, because the parents are the first people that love us. So if we don't feel like we're loved by our parents, it's going to be hard for us to love other people, to take in love and to give it. So it could be the attachment. It could be as kids are growing up, if there are issues within the family. I know sometimes it's not always attachment. Kids were attached when they were younger, but when they hit adolescence, there might have been some issues or parents divorced and they didn't have access to a parent or, you know, a parent may have remarried and it created some problems. A lot of times it comes out later on for people. They're not necessarily conscious of it. And so a lot of times it will come out when people are in therapy with me or other therapists.
Now, what if a woman says that her father wasn't around? Is that cause for concern?
Sometimes. So, you know, again, I think it depends on the person. But sometimes people have other people that can step in, like an uncle or grandfather, and they they can provide support and they can be a good, you know, male role model. But other times it might be that that does create a problem. And so if a person didn't have access to one parent, and this is true for men too, it's not just women, but if the person didn't have access to one of the parents and they don't feel like there's a connection, it could create problems in romantic relationships.
I've read things where, for example, let's say it's a household where there's no dad present, mm-hmm. let's say, and a girl grows up with her mom.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the first example of a relationship is, again, our parents.
Exactly.
So if there was never, I guess, a benchmark to kind of, or a standard to kind of set to, when a woman grows up and tries to go into a relationship, she doesn't have anything to base what her relationship should be like.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any truth to that?
Yeah. I would say yes. I would say that there's some truth to that, definitely. If you, you know, because a lot of things that we learn, we're influenced by our family. It's modeled by our parents. So good behavior, bad behavior, a lot of times we pick that up from our parents. And so if you witness like a loving, affectionate relationship between your parents, I think you have a better chance of having that in your own relationship. That's not to say, though, that everybody that doesn't have access to both parents is going to not be able to create a relationship that's good and healthy. But I think certainly having that model makes a difference.
Now, what else should we look for?
Again, I said like neediness. Like if somebody's really needy, that's not necessarily a good sign. If they've cheated before, I'm doing some work on infidelity in men and women. And usually if people tell you that, that's not such a good sign. They'll sometimes try to make excuses for it. Why cheated? Because, you know, my boyfriend wasn't there or my girlfriend wasn't there. But that's not necessarily always the truth. And so if people have that history, oftentimes that history is repeated. So if a girl tells a guy that on a first date, that's not necessarily a good sign.
In your research, there's been a long, long time theory or hypothesis that men and women cheat for different reasons. But sometimes mm-hmm. when we break that down, I don't know if that's necessarily true because, I mean, we're both similar in many ways, men and women,
mm-hmm.
That maybe at the core center, there is no difference in the reasoning why men cheat, women cheat.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any truth to that?
I think a lot of the research says that women cheat for emotional reasons. There's something missing in their relationship with their husband, their boyfriend, partner. And so they will seek out another person to fill that emotional void, whereas the literature will say that men cheat for physical reasons, that there's an attraction to another woman, and they'll step out on the relationship for that reason. I think it's a combination of both, and I think we're seeing that it's both for both sexes, that there are certainly men who have things that are missing in their relationship, a connection, and so they'll seek out another woman for that reason. And there are certainly women who I think seek out other relationships outside of their relationship for sexual reasons and not just for intimacy.
So there are definitely some similarities. There's also, and this is a lot of the guys will use this excuse that it's in the male biology, that it's in the male DNA to not be with one woman. That it's our animalistic instinct to be with many women. Now, I don't know if that's the way they justify what they do or that there is some truth to that.
Well, I mean, there's different research out there. And so some of the research says that we're not monogamous creatures, male or female. And so that what we're doing when we enter into marriages really isn't necessarily natural. However, you know, society's rules and things like that, I think, come into play. And when people make a commitment, I think most people expect that that commitment is going to be honored. But there are different kinds of relationships out there, too. I mean, there's some people that are open, have open relationships where both partners are cool with that. You know, if that's the case, then that's something different. But yeah, I mean, I think there's research to support that most people might not be monogamous. It's that we choose to be for religious, societal reasons, etc.
Because in the animal kingdom, no animals are really faithful, I guess, the way humans are, or try to be faithful, or try to be monogamous. And maybe we're just doing something against what we were intended to do. It should be one big free-for-all, maybe.
I don't know. that's a good question, Rob. I'm not sure. I know. I think it depends, though, on like what the partners decide. So if you know they decide that it's going to be an open relationship or a polyamorous relationship, if you know the partner's okay with it, then I think that's fine. I'm not one to judge. You know, that's therapists don't usually do that. So if that's what floats the person's boat, then by all means, you know, do what makes you happy. But I think you also have to consider like societal stuff and, you know, pressures and all of those things. And that, you know, if people are expecting to be monogamous in their relationships, then I think that has to be honored too, if that makes sense.
Another fear that men seem to have is once you're in the relationship, and I know you said you wouldn't call it psycho, the guys that listen to the show will call these women psycho women or psycho chicks.
Right.
Once they're in the relationship with these women, they say that it's almost difficult to get out because the woman will make it difficult. How do you let someone down when you want to get out? And it's just like, I wish I had some of the emails in front of me, but some of these guys are so desperate to get out, they don't know how to get out. It sounds kind of funny because we usually in mainstream media we'll hear women who can't get out of an abusive relationship.
Yeah.
But some of these guys have been attacked. There was just one of the guys who wrote in once that he broke up with this girl because she was jealous. She was going through his phone, his computer, and he just couldn't take that anymore. And he broke up with her.
Mm-hmm.
And he was walking down, crossing the street one day, and she almost ran him over. That's how angry she was.
Okay.
It almost becomes difficult to get away once you're in. How do you handle someone who's gone to that point where it's just, I mean, maybe just call the cops, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the same as with women who find themselves in similar situations. And you mentioned something, and those are two signs also. Like if someone also tells you that they're very jealous or they're very angry or they get angry and they'll give you scenarios about things that have happened in previous relationships, those are also signs too. But I think you have to do what I deal with a lot of domestic violence. I teach that actually. I've been teaching that class for 10 years at one of the universities where I work. And it's the same, whether the victim or survivor is male or female. You know, if you feel threatened, even as a man, you need to, you know, call the police, make that known. Men typically don't like to do that because there's a lot of stigma attached to it, or sometimes they don't have really good interactions with the police who, you know, will kind of say things like, well, you know, you're a man up, you should be able to deal with this. But if, you know, somebody's being stalked, if they're being harassed, if they're being, you know, run over by a car, or, you know, somebody's intimidated to do that, then that's a call for you to, you know, seek out police, seek out legal help.
The scary thing about situations like that is that's when tragedies occur.
Yeah.
Someone ultimately ends up getting hurt, whether it's the woman who's trying to hurt the guy, or the guy's maybe trying to defend himself, and then it just gets really, really ugly. So, which now I think is a good segue to go into these different personalities that, that people have. And so I guess we kind of covered that there are certain issues that maybe might have taken place when people are growing up.
Mm-hmm.
But our personalities, are we born with our own personalities? Or is it a series of things that we learn growing up that form our personalities and who we are?
You know, I think it's both, honestly. I think that people come here with, you know, their own personalities. You know, in a family, you can certainly have several kids who have the same mom and dad, and they have completely different personalities. You know, one person might be quiet, one person might be more outgoing, but had the same parents, had the same upbringing. We're also influenced by, you know, family's values, what's modeled for us, our relationship with peers. So sometimes in the same family, people might have had different peer relationships that have formed their personality. So I think it's a combination of both. I think there's some biological stuff. I think people come with their personality. And I think there's some things that we learn from our parents from whomever is raising us.
I guess if we're born with our personalities, and let's say you're dealing with a child that maybe is short-tempered, I guess the time to tweak that is when they're children.
Absolutely.
Because my objective has always been, I mean, it's great that we have doctors like yourself to help us when we're adults to correct the things that I guess we're screwed up as kids, whether it was our parents or our surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great that we have doctors to help us with that. But my goal has always been, I want to raise my son so that he doesn't have to need therapy, and that we don't screw him up so that he needs to spend years in therapy to fix everything we messed up. So I guess when we see that, it's when we have to correct it. How do you correct something like that? Let's say a child who for no reason is throwing temper tantrums.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. I think you have to correct that early on. One of my areas of specialization is that I'm a child adolescent psychologist. And so that is one of the populations that I actually like to work with the most, because you actually see change. With adults, it's a little bit harder. You know, if you've been doing the same thing for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, you're kind of set in your ways. But with kids, if you can kind of break that early on, you're correct, Rob. I think you can make an impact. And, you know, prevent kids from maybe having to go to therapy, or maybe having some of these issues that we were talking about earlier with dating. But, you know, early on, you want to deal with that. As a parent, you want to set really firm boundaries. If you're having trouble as a parent dealing with that yourself, then it's a good idea to, like, seek outside help, like from a therapist. I've worked with a lot of families who have kids who have some of the issues that you're talking about, or have ADHD, or, you know, are acting out of class and at home. And you really want to try to nip that in the bud as early on as possible, so that that kid has a good corrective experience and it impacts their behavior in a positive way.
And I guess the same thing could be said for other different types of traits. I've heard parents who will say that the child or their child is shy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shy child that they're not necessarily hanging out with the other children in class.
Uh-huh.
They tend to be by themselves. All these different things, temper tantrums, shyness, things like that. There is hope for parents who are dealing with this kind of stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, they just need to, I think, address it. Parents, I think, need to also be really open with their kids. And one of the things I think is not always modeled in families is open communication. So most families, most parents don't necessarily model really open communication between themselves or with their kids. But they're being really open with their kids, and they're talking to their kids early on about issues, how they're doing at school, who their friends are. It prevents a lot of the problems that I would see later on in, like, adolescence or early adulthood. So if you're talking to your kids about, like, their experiences at school, and they're telling you, like, for example, they're bullied, I mean, that's a time when a parent can intervene. But oftentimes, parents don't know that because they're not even asking those questions, and kids aren't necessarily going to tell you that without you, you know, somewhat prying. So I think it's a good idea for parents to really model that early on. It makes a world of difference.
A lot of the mistakes that parents make is that my wife and I see it when, you know, we take our son to the park or to a music class or to one of the things that he's involved in, that they tend, and maybe I don't think they do it, you know, on purpose. I think it's just something that comes very natural, that they label their children in a certain category.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the reason why I brought, like, shyness and temper tantrums and things like that is that I've seen parents at the park, you know, oh my boy, he's shy.
Mm-hmm.
He's a shy one. He's quiet. He's to himself. And I think that a child begins to hear that, and he automatically maybe puts himself in that category. Well, I'm shy.
Mm-hmm.
Or the other parent who's scolding his kid, I don't want to, you're doing a temper tantrum, you're being mean, you're being a bad boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they hear that over and over, and then they begin to live up to the label that maybe their own parent has given them.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. I've seen that often in my work with children and families. Sometimes the parents will give kids labels and they become that. So the shy one, the bad one, the black sheep, and then kids, you know, will actually become that. So it's not always a good idea to label kids, but to talk to them about issues, I think, is really a good thing. So, for example, you mentioned, like, a kid who's shy. It's not always shyness. Sometimes it's introversion, which is a little bit different from shyness. So, you know, they're extroverts, people that are more outgoing, more gregarious, you know, like the life of the party kind of folks. And then there are people that are more reserved, more observant. And it may be that, not necessarily shyness. And it's just two ways of being that are different. So it's not necessarily a negative, but sometimes parents will make it a negative.
And they might do it not knowing so. You know, they're just, yes. Oh, he's shy. So now let's say a child has gone through all that and now they're a little screwy because mom and dad did the wrong things. And they're going into, they become teenagers, they become adults, and then they're out in the real world and they're having struggles with work, with relationships because of all the things that occurred in their childhood. They were born with a certain personality and then things they learned at home added to that. And now they're seeking help. Now they're going to someone like yourself looking for help to help them. They want to be successful. They want to be happy. And they want to do and correct all the things, all the shortcomings that they think they have because of the experiences in life. Can someone change their personality or their way of being when they've been doing the same thing for years, when they were taught to be a certain way because they were labeled, because they were born with a certain personality? As adults, can we tweak that and change it? Or do people simply do not change? And this is the hand that you were dealt with, and that's what you got to deal with.
No, I think people can absolutely change. I think that's one of the positives about the work that I do, is you can see people, even as adults, make significant changes. But they have to be willing to want to do the work. So sometimes people will tell you they want to make changes, but they really don't want to do the work. Or they will gain insight, but not necessarily change the behavior. So lots of people who are very insightful about what's going on with them. Like you said, they may be, to use a non-technical term, a little screwy. But they might, you know, have some psychological issues, I'll say. And if they want to change that, they can. Oftentimes, again, they'll get insight through therapy or through their own work, through introspection, through talking to pastor, priest, friends, whatever, you know, works for that person. But they won't be able to necessarily change their behavior. And if, without the behavior change, you don't see the change that you're talking about. So, for example, if somebody is using drugs, I've had a lot of clients who are on drugs. They'll participate in like 12-step. They may even go through rehab. They have some insight. They know maybe it's connected to family of origin issues, like the issues that we were talking about earlier, but they don't make the behavioral change. They don't stop using drugs, or they don't stay away from people who are a bad influence, who are, you know, still in the drug scene. Without that behavioral change, you really don't see the change that you're talking about. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Now, that behavioral change, that sounds like it's an uphill battle. It sounds difficult. I mean, you're changing behavior that was embedded in you for years.
Yes.
And it's got to be difficult.
It is. It is very difficult for people to make changes, you know, whether that's in relationships or whether it has to do with drugs and alcohol or any of the things that we've been talking about. But I think if people are conscious about it, they're aware of it, and they actively make steps towards doing that, it's possible. But with substance abuse, for example, there's a lot of talk about this in the literature, and you see it when you're working with people with substance abuse issues. People move forward and they move backward. They move forward, they move backward. You know, it's called relapse, and it's well known to be a part of recovery with substance abuse. But honestly, I think I've seen that with every other issue. It's not just limited to substance abuse. People who, let's say we were talking earlier about dating and relationships, people tend to attract the same kind of people. I don't think we talked about that earlier.
That's actually a great point that you bring up. But please go on.
Yeah, so they tend to attract the same kind of people. So guys that might be emailing you, talking to you about like women who are crazy or psycho, to use the terms that they were using. Oftentimes, if you really ask them, they're attracting the same person every time.
I actually have friends like that. I'm like, you didn't learn from the last time.
Right.
And it's just, you know, one type of woman over and over, like the needy woman over and over
exactly.
again. And
right.
Text messages like mm-hmm. nonstop, and this guy can't even breathe. Wow, it's crazy. Uh-huh. But yeah, I see exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
It goes the same thing with women. They complain that guys are douchebags,
uh-huh.
and they continue to date the same kind
same
of guys.
Guy.
I'm like,
right,
same guy, mm-hmm. just different name, different dude, different area, but same douchebag,
same and exact guy. Right, exactly.
But why is that?
That's the part that isn't the behavior change. So they might be aware of it. They're talking about it. They're like, yeah, you know, I date this guy. He's a douchebag. This other one's a douchebag. But they haven't connected that to the behavior change. So they haven't started to change the behavior. Like when they start dating, they're not asking the questions that we were talking about earlier. And they get into the same kind of relationship. They do the same behavior, if that makes sense. They're not just using the insight that they've gained from dating the same person over and over again or talking to friends about it. And everybody's pointed out the pattern, but they haven't changed the behavior. And that's actually what changes. So people can change, but they have to be willing to connect the insight to the behavior change. I was listening to an interview you did with Maureen Shea, the boxer, and she was talking about therapy and her own journey. And,
yes.
You know, I think that that's really important for a lot of people to understand. There's a lot of stigma around therapy, especially in like communities of color. Lots of people in communities of color will say we don't do that. You know, we don't talk about our problems outside the home. What happens in this house stays in this house. You know, you probably heard that a lot. I heard that growing up.
All the time. People are afraid of therapy. And like you said, in different ethnic groups or ethnic backgrounds, in the Latino culture, mm-hmm. Myself being Latino, mm-hmm. that if ever that came up in a conversation, you should go see a therapist. Well, only crazy people go to therapists.
Right.
I'm not crazy. I'm not going to the therapist.
Exactly.
You know, it's, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's a machismo thing. People are afraid mm-hmm. of the therapist and they shouldn't. I think it should be something that we embrace, that if this will help us live happier lives. I mean, ultimately, that's the goal. We're here for, when you really think about it, we're here on Earth for such a short time.
Mm-hmm.
I know like people in my family on my mother's side, my grandmother lived to be 108.
Oh, wow.
My grandfather lived to be 90-something.
Uh-huh.
You know, my grandmother had gone beyond 100 years. Her mind was like intact. It was perfect. I would still get birthday cards, Christmas cards from her.
Oh, wow.
Really a fascinating woman. But something that she said later on in her life when she was beyond 100 years old was she told me, Robert, you need to live your life and live it the happiest that you can
mm-hmm.
because life is short.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, my grandmother is over 100 years old and she's telling me that life is short.
Uh-huh.
Someone who's lived over 100 years is telling me that life is short.
Uh-huh.
So the average American life is 70 something, 80 years old.
Yes.
You know, it's even 100 years is too short. So ultimately the goal is to be happy, to make the best of it while we're here.
Absolutely.
And if therapy can help people live happy and healthier lives, then we should be all for it. Dr. Gregory Canillas, this was such a great conversation. One of my favorites ever.
Thank you.
That I would definitely love to do this again. Is there anywhere where people can reach out to you if they have questions, or do you have a website, or where can people interact with you on social media?
Sure. So my Facebook is Gregory Canillas. Last name is Canillas. On Twitter, I'm Dr. GJ Canillas. And IG, Dr. C9. And then I'm an assistant professor at the Chicago School. And I can be reached by email at gcaneas@thechicagoschool.edu.
Emily, welcome.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you for having me.
So, Emily, you're going to talk to us about, I think, an issue that a lot of people deal with. And I hear it in so many different circles, whether you're into sports, whether you're trying to run a business, or just anything in general in life, we sometimes tend to talk ourselves out of being successful.
Mm-hmm.
And those that are successful, I guess, have a different mindset. And the title of your book, How to Permanently Erase Negative Self-Talk So You Can Be Extraordinary gives us a glimpse into how we accomplish this.
Yes. Yes, it is based on a very powerful psycho-spiritual healing model that was developed by a psychologist by the name of Dr. Richard Schwartz. And as we talk, I'll take people through the origins of how this was developed and how we could use these techniques beyond psychotherapy in order to unleash our true greatness.
I think a lot of times we are always thinking about the worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that although it's good to plan ahead, it's good to think of the different possibilities of any particular outcome. When we overthink too much about the worst case scenario, sometimes the worst case scenario ends up taking place. But maybe because we ourselves alluded to it, or we're preparing for it, or we've already envisioned it. And it's almost like a path to failure.
Yes.
So how do we stop that?
So it is in our natural way of thinking, because we always want to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. But what we don't realize is that when we are thinking all those negative thoughts, you know, a lot of the personal development and self-help books talk about how your thoughts and your beliefs about yourself and the situation produces a corresponding vibration. And when things are negative, you're producing that negative vibration, which gets sent out into the universe. And so that's what this, you know, woo-woo universe picks up. And so if you're thinking that things are negative, like, oh, I'm never going to lose weight, I'm going to try, but I'm always a fat, you know, I'm going to be fat, and or, you know, I've never succeeded before, I'm just going to fail again. Well, that's your broadcast out to the universe that that is what you actually want. And so that's why we end up setting ourselves up for failure. And we don't even know it, even though we're trying to protect ourselves. And the reason why we even have these negative thoughts in the first place is that it's all based on what happened to us, especially in our childhood. Those messages that we have been programmed with as a result of significant emotional events, either with our caretakers, mom or dad, or teachers, or bullies, or your siblings, or any other authority figure. Because when we're young, you know, we're trying to make sense of why things are happening to us. And when negative things happen to us, even that dirty look from mom or dad not spending enough time with you, or the teacher saying that you're not as bright as the other kids in the class, or the coach saying that you're never going to make varsity, all of those things that happen to us produces and programs beliefs into our mind that says, I'm not good enough. I am not enough. And so they get frozen in time, those moments of rejection and shame and blame and embarrassment. And so as we try to live out our lives and we grow older and we grow into our 20s and 30s, and especially when we're in the 30s and 40s and we're trying to accomplish so much, these are the very voices that come up as we're trying to either attract a better partner or manifest some more business success or have our health be better or just feeling good about ourselves. And whatever it is in your life that you're trying to improve, when you don't have what you want, it can all, for the most part, can be traced back with some programmed negative belief that is in your brain as a result of these significant emotional events.
When you break it down like that, it's very kind of scary to a point where an adult can really damage a child for life based on how they speak to them. And that is very powerful.
Yes, and these are the very, very things that are holding us back because we're stuck in the past. Because these parts of us, and we may be frozen at a 10-year-old memory and we don't even know it's that 10-year-old part of us that is overtaking our psyche and holding us back from either approaching the pretty girl or asking for picking up the phone to call somebody important. I'll give you a classic example. I have many clients that have had these parts of them that had kept them stuck in, especially midlife. And that is, you know, I'm the parent of a 23-year-old. And so I wish I knew all of this before I even had him. But anyhow, so here's how this can happen. Johnny brings home a report card and it's full of B's and maybe one A. And mom and dad are looking at Johnny and says, "What's the matter with you? See, if you just studied harder, you would have gotten more A's. Come on, what is it that you expect to get into a good college with those B grades? It's I'm ashamed of you. You got to do better the next time." So many of us had either those experiences, or we have inadvertently given some negative messages to our kids. Maybe not to that extent, but saying, you're not good enough with that B. Where's the A? Because I know you're capable of the A. And so what happens is that part of you gets frozen in time. Maybe you're 10 years old and mom and dad are criticizing you for the B's on your report card. You're not getting any support. And it happens over and over again, something similar to that. So never getting the approval that you really needed, that you are good enough just the way that you are. And so Johnny grows up and tries to get promoted at work. He reaches a certain level, but then the next level, getting into some leadership position, he just can't seem to get the guts to apply, and he can't seem to muster up the confidence during the interview to get the job, even though he knows he's capable of doing it. So at those moments, those important moments, that's when the messages of mom and dad, that 10-year-old part of him is like, "Who do you think you are? Mom and dad never said that you're smart enough or good enough. After all, you were the one that didn't get into the designer school. You got into just a state school." And so those are the messages that come up over and over again that stops him from believing in himself. And so instead of mom or dad saying it like, giving negative reinforcement, maybe a better way of saying it is like, "Hey, Johnny, I'm so proud of you for this report card. I know that you did the best that you can. How do you feel about the grades that you have on this report card?" And Johnny may very well say, "Well, I wish I had a couple more A's. I know I'm capable of that. I kind of messed up with some of the B's." Then as a parent, you could say something like, "Well, then what can we do to support you to get more A's? Because we know you did the best that you could for this report card, but we're here to support you to get whatever it is that you feel you're capable of."
So it's important to address this early on, avoid hurting someone like this so that they can be successful when they get older. I think every parent or every individual that's planning to be a parent should understand these philosophies so that they don't make these very crucial mistakes that are without a doubt life-changing. So we fast forward to, let's say, adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we correct that? How do we train our brain to do something that we were trained to think from early on, and we've been obviously consistently doing it throughout our lives? How do we change that? Because you hear very often, it's kind of a cliche at this point, where people don't really change. This is who we are because of, like you said before, our experiences or what we were taught, what we saw, what we learned. But is it possible to change some of that and tweak it so that we can live extraordinary lives, so that we can be successful?
It is very possible to live an extraordinary life and to be successful. And it all starts with you. That means if you want to change your life, you have to change. What you need to do is to fall madly in love with yourself. I know that sounds kind of cliche, but at the end of the day, for those people that, even if they have all the money status and stuff in the world, let's say they've achieved the Madison Avenue definition of success of materialism and looking like everything is successful, a lot of those people have really awful relationships, or they may be addicted to drugs and alcohol. They're still emotionally empty. And all of that is because, they're trying to achieve through materialism and money, trying to get the validation. But at the end of the day, they're not in love with themselves because of all of these young parts of them that, with these voices. You're not good enough. You're not smart enough. You're fat, whatever it is. And so in order to change your life and feel really centered and attract what you want, you have to change into the best version of yourself. because it is the energy of the best version of you that will have the universe have you be at the right place at the right time to meet the right people and to give you the right opportunities that you need in order to live a successful and happy life. And so the first step to change is awareness. Awareness of these parts of you that are holding down on the brakes on the bus of your life. Because you're trying to drive forward and push on the gas pedal of the bus of your life, whether it be better health, better relationships, more financial success, or just trying to get more spiritually centered. Whatever that is, you're trying to push hard on the gas pedal, but there are these, the negative self-talk, these parts of you that are on the brakes, your feelings, beliefs, and thoughts about who you are that are holding you back. And these are the parts of you that are frozen in time. And what happens is some of these are, you know, are the vulnerable memory parts, you know, the 5-year-old part, the 8-year-old part, whatever, 9-year-old part that were shamed and rejected and embarrassed. And what happens is that when we have these parts of us frozen in time, other parts of us go into extreme behaviors. So in other words, the parts of us that used to have be balanced in terms of how we eat, how we drink, how we gamble or whatever it is. You know, just think of people you know or relatives or friends that eats too much, drinks too much, shops too much, works too much. Any behavior, feelings, or thought that is to an extreme, including like depression, sadness, anxiety. Those are all extreme beliefs, feelings, and behaviors. These are the parts of us that have to take on extreme roles in order to protect the vulnerable memories, those parts of us that are holding on to shame and rejection and fear. And so when people, so the first thing to look at to identify the parts of you that are holding you back is look at the behaviors, thoughts, and feelings that are not serving you. Eating too much, working too much, procrastination, anger, sadness, fears, addiction, too much drinking, too much gambling, too much of whatever. Because those are, I think with the eating too much, a lot of people can relate because they're doing emotional eating or drinking a little too much to kind of numb things out and to not to think about some of those things. And so those are the things that have to be identified and you have to get to know so that these parts of you that are holding you back, that are protecting the parts of you that are holding on to negative beliefs, such as I'm not enough, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not worthy, whatever it is. So these are all interrelated with each other and they're all in extreme roles. And this is your inner team that you need to heal in order for these parts of you to get off the brakes of your life. Because these parts of you are holding down on the brakes of your life, and when you befriend them and understand why it is that they are holding on to these faulty beliefs, and you do the work of healing them, because you as the highest self of who you are, that real you, that is that diamond inside of you, that is full of self-love, this highest part of who you are can heal all of these parts that are stuck in the past, that are holding down on the brakes. And when you heal them and love them, that's how you fall madly in love with yourself. These parts of you get off the brakes of your life and they become your magical inner team that sits on the back seat, the passenger seats of the bus of your life with cheerleading pom-poms on, rooting you on as you are trying to get a promotion, make more money, attract a better lover, be a better parent. So these are all the parts of you that need to be on the same inner team in order for you to move forward and unleash success and happiness and true love and whatever it is that you want in your life. And so there's a whole process on how to identify these parts of you so that you could get to know them. And then you negotiate with them, okay? If we go and get that vulnerable part of me that is stuck in the classroom when the teacher shamed me and told me I'm stupid, you get to go and quote unquote reparent that 8-year-old part of you that was shamed by the teacher and rescue that part of you out of the past and reprogram that 8-year-old's brain that, you know what, Johnny, it wasn't your fault that the teacher said this. She just didn't know any better. I'm here for you. You're very bright. And you're going to help me be on this team where we're going to go and make the phone call to that important customer so that we could get that $1 million contract. So this is about getting all of these parts of you that are stuck in vulnerable memories out of the past, and they become a part of your team, your inner team, to help you drive the bus of your life forward.
How difficult is this to take that first step?
If people are willing to spend the time to really understand what this process is all about based on internal family systems, it's called the internal family systems model of psychospiritual healing because we are an internal family. We have a family of our parts. You know, that committee of characters that's in our brain, every time we're trying to do something, the voice is inside of us. And so these are the parts of us that need to be in the same cohesive internal family so that we're all on the same sheet of music to drive that bus forward. So there's a whole protocol, and people could get a free download of this protocol of getting to know your parts. Identify the parts of you that are on the brakes. And the first step is, you know, you have to know where you want to go. You have to identify where you want to go. So you have to put a destination into the GPS of the bus of your life. Is it better health? Is it better, more money? Is it better relationships? Whatever it is. A lot of times people don't even know where they're going and where they want to go. And so if you don't even plug something into the GPS, how do you expect the bus to start moving? So that's the first step. So there's a whole process of identifying what those steps are. And for if people want a free download of that, they could download it from nonegativetalk.com. Nonegativetalk.com is going to give you the protocol of how to identify these parts and getting to know these parts of you that could be keeping you stuck from living the life that you want. And then so a lot of the work you can do yourself if you want to spend the time to do it. Because this is – in my book, I say, you know, reading this book is not going to solve your problems after you finish reading it. Because in order for you to become the best version of you, you do have to invest the time and energy to do this work because this didn't develop overnight. So overnight, it's not like you're going to be able to erase this in 24 hours. So how long it takes you, it all depends on what's underneath this. You know, I've had people that they've coached with me for 6 hours total and they're totally ready to unleash. And then I've had other people that needed 30 or 40 hours of coaching in order to get to that next level. And we're talking about, you know, success and happiness for people who are psychologically stable and healthy and who want to take their lives to the next level way beyond what psychotherapy is. This is about unleashing the full potential of who you are. And so I can't tell you exactly how long this is going to take because that would not be responsible of me to say, okay, everybody, it's just going to take you like 2 or 3 hours worth of work. So they can start to download the protocol, nonegativetalk.com. And so I kind of have given you the overview based on this bus metaphor of this is what keeps you stuck from living the successful, happy life that you truly deserve and want. Because you have to think about pushing your life forward. What is it that you want? And then identifying the parts of you that are keeping you stuck, those negative voices. Because those negative voices is what also produces a lower level energy that is not very attractive to the universe to give you all the amazing opportunities that you need in order to take your life to the next level.
But you mentioned the universe a couple of times. Mm-hmm. What in essence is the universe? Is it the world around us? Is it our inner circle? What is meant by the universe?
The universe, you have to really trust in a higher power. This is not about some sort of religion per se. It's more about believing that there is some sort of force working above you that is going to orchestrate the twists and turns that your life is going to inevitably take on your journey to living out your best life. Because success is not a straight line, as we all know. And it's twists and turns and speed bumps and hiccups. And you just have to trust that failure is your path, guaranteed path to success. But you have to have the courage to believe in yourself enough to say, okay, I'm just going to keep going. You know, I failed with this thing and it must be leading me to something else. Because I know in my own entrepreneurial journey in the last 4 years, there's been a lot of hiccups and speed bumps. And it's all because I did those things that I was rewarded ultimately with what I needed to do to be where I needed to be in order to attract the opportunities. And I couldn't have orchestrated some of this stuff if I had wanted to. You just have to take inspired action. And as you take inspired action, that is when the next steps will get revealed to you. And you have to trust that it's all going to work out.
Now, failing doesn't mean it's the end of the road. I think a lot of people have that fear. Oh, I failed. I'm done. And they don't bother giving it another shot or maybe replanning their approach. And that could very well tie into the whole negative talk where I failed. I'm not going to bother. It's over. Why bother at this point?
Yes. And you have to fail many, 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 many times before you get that big success. And so failure, if and when you do fail, yes, it hurts. And if you don't do the work of understanding how your past failures, especially in childhood, prevent you from having the courage to fail again, then oftentimes people get stuck because they haven't done the inner work. Because the bottom line is, in order for any of us to reach that next level, whatever the definition of your next level is, one must go back. In order to move forward in our lives, we must go back into the past in order to move, take quantum leaps, and unleash the true greatness of who we are. Because oftentimes, the pains that we suffered are all meant to be part of the journey in your life story. And when you could change the story of why bad things happen to you, and that, again, here's the word again, the universe has planned these bad events for the evolution of your soul.
Is it also fair to say that we kind of bring these negative things or these bad things that happen to us along this journey that we call life? Are those at times self-inflicted as well?
Yes, in some ways. Because it's easy when bad things happen to us to blame the circumstances, blame the people. And if things like negative things like that keep happening over and over again to you, or if you're like attracting the same bad relationships over and over again, well, I think it's time to look inward. And so one of my favorite quotes is the law of magnetism, which is, you will not attract what you want into your life. You will attract who you are.
Very powerful.
So if you do have any dark or heavy energies, these are the thoughts, beliefs, and emotions that are stuck in the past. And so this energy is not going to attract anything good to come into your life. And these are the parts of you, because this is who you are, that are stuck on the brakes of the bus of your life. So you will not attract what you want into your life, which is only 10% responsible, or conscious thinking, I want a better body, I want more money. You will attract who you are. And who you are is the 90% of those beliefs, thoughts, and feelings that you have about yourself that are in the subconscious, that are controlled by all of these, for the most part, many of these parts of you that are still stuck in the past.
We can change this energy that we put out using the same principles that you teach in your book?
Yes. Yes. Because the dark and... So think about when you walk into a party or when you go into some social event and you're like, oh, Jane's going to be there. Wow, I love her energy. I love being around her. Oh, John's going to be there. Oh, he sucks the energy out of me.
We all know people like that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not because they're bad people, because it dark people with dark and heavy energies, ooh, if you really got into their head and really dug out what they're really thinking inside of them, it's all a lot of negative stuff. And so that energy, our thoughts and feelings have that energy that we cannot even see, that has others just be repulsed. We can't even put our finger on it, but we intuitively know. And so the people who have the best energies and are happy, and for the most part, they're the ones who are like in the popular circles. They're the ones who are not afraid to go up to strangers and strike up a conversation with strangers at the bar, because they're not afraid of rejection, because they know how to interact with people. And so it's the energy that attracts your opportunities. I'll give you a little example. How I even got my book deal is I couldn't even have planned it if I tried. So back in April 2014, I was at a reception in New York City, like almost 100 people. I barely knew anybody. And in the middle of the reception, amongst all these people, I started talking to some guy that was standing next to me, making small talk. He starts asking me like 50 questions within like 20 minutes. Who are you? What do you do? Blah, 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 blah. And I'm just talking all about myself. I didn't have a chance to even reciprocate and ask him who he was. And then at the end of 20 minutes, he's like, do you have a book in mind? It's like, oh, sure. 2 weeks ago, you know, I put in my journal that writing a book in 2014 was a top priority. I don't even know how I'm going to accomplish that. I hate to write. I don't have an agent. I don't blah, blah, blah. He's like, stop. He says, you have no idea who you have been talking to for the last 20 minutes. You have been talking to a publisher, and I would love to publish your book. I'll take on all the risks. And I'm like, it's like, is this really happening? This doesn't usually happen when people get a book deal. And so, again, this is, you know, I talk about the universe. That was not a coincidence that I was there at some strange place that I didn't even know. I didn't even know why I was going. And in the middle of a crowded room, what were the chances that a publisher was going to be standing right next to me? And he had no idea I had publishing a book in my mind. And the reason I even got to that reception is because 2 months prior, I was at a bar in New York City waiting for some meeting to start. I was early. I went up to the bar and I just like started a conversation with three guys at the bar. And one of those persons was somebody important in New York. He invited me to come down to his office, talk with him further because he was fascinated with what I did. And then those conversations eventually led me to getting invited to this party. And so, again, that's a higher power working on my behalf because I had already put in what I wanted to accomplish into the GPS of the bus of my life. I didn't have to know exactly how I was going to get there. I just knew and believed in myself enough to say, I'm just going to let things unfold. I just have to take the next step, do the scary things of just talking to strangers, just going and showing up. Because half of life and half of the opportunities or a lot of the opportunities people get, you just have to show up and do something uncomfortable. Uncomfortable that it might make you fail, but nevertheless, having the courage to do something you've never done before. And in order to have that courage, you do have to do the inner work to believe in yourself 110% because you're never going to rise above what you believe is true about yourself.
What a great way to bring that full circle. That's a great story. So it's a few things in play, but I think it comes down to the power of our mind to put out the right energy. I like how you put that with putting where you want to go on that GPS.
Yes.
Because if you don't have the sense of direction or at least that goal in mind, there's no way to find your journey, your path to that goal. So I think it's really, really, really important that people understand these philosophies and that people go out and get this book, How to Permanently Erase Negative Self-Talk So That You Can Be Extraordinary. Emily, thank you so much for sharing your story, for sharing the point of views, this philosophy on how we can truly live an extraordinary life if we commit ourselves to it. Because I think that's part of it. You have to commit. You have to decide to take that first step and then do the work that it takes to get there.
Yeah. And it's also recognizing that if you don't want to put something into the GPS, because that's also a part that's saying, no, we're not doing it. It's too scary. I don't want to do the work. Okay. So also recognizing that there are, if you don't want to put a destination into that GPS, then these are the parts of you that say, well, now we have to be accountable if we put something in. We'd rather just live a mediocre life. And if that's what you want, that's okay. You know, not everyone is meant to live to the full potential who they're meant to be. And so you have to come to terms with what it is that you want. And lastly, it's really about, you know, here's my number one tip. Do the work to fall madly in love with yourself. And that energy of self-love and belief in you is going to manifest magic in your business, in your relationships, in your health, and in your state of joy.
Great stuff, Emily. Thank you so much. So now where can people find you either on social media, website? How can people interact and get more information from you.
Okay. If people wanted the steps to download to understand the erase negative self-talk steps, they can go to nonegativetalk.com and just give me your email and then you will get sent the steps. And then my website is bemoreextraordinary.com. Bemoreextraordinary.com.
Fantastic. Emily, thank you so much. This was very informative, eye-opening, and I think if people apply these philosophies, they can achieve everything they set out to. Thank you so much for your time.